Case number 12-5057, Roxanne J. Franklin Mason, Appellant v. Raymond Edwin Mabus, Jr., Secretary, Department of the Navy. Ms. Jones for the appellant, Mr. Birch for the appellee.
Good morning. Your Honor, I've requested 2 minutes of rebuttal time. I would also like to note the presence of the plaintiff, Mrs. Franklin Mason, in the courtroom. May it please the Court, good morning. The United States, Your Honors, is not immune from being held in contempt of Judge Sullivan's court order. Nor is the United States immune from the imposition of being subjected to the coercive powers and inherent powers of the Article III judge as a result of its violation of Judge Sullivan's court order. Article III judges have the power to enforce under its inherent powers, and the power to enforce orders as to the United States government. As the court wrote in the case of Donahue versus Broderick, Broderick versus Donahue, where in that case an issue was raised as to the abuse of discretion of the Article III judge in the course of finding the SEC in violation of a order of judgment.
Does our power to the district court's power to enforce here include the power to prevent damages for the kind of breach that occurred here?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Do you have a case for that?
Well, I would submit that the Broderick case suggests that. I would submit, Your Honors, that the inherent power of the judge to coerce and punish by the imposition of potentially of sanctions and contempt is part and parcel of its ability to enforce this order. Otherwise, the Article III judge has no real ability to enforce its order.
I'm sorry. Where in your brief do you cite Broderick?
I'm not sure that I did, Your Honor, but I thought I did. Okay. Your Honor, I did not cite Broderick. And the United States did not cite Broderick. Nevertheless, Your Honor, and again, Broderick was a case where the United States had lost the trial, I believe, and that the order was an order of judgment in which the government violated. The United States has not argued that it is not susceptible to and subjective to the Article III judge's ability to enforce a court order against them.
Yep. Enforcement is enforcement, and injunctive power, the Supreme Court has time and again drawn a radical distinction between injunctive power and even fines to supplement the carrying out of injunctive relief, and on the one and the, on the other hand, damages. So I think you have to go beyond that generality to get jurisdiction in the district court.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that that would be an issue of separation of powers as opposed to sovereign immunity. But notwithstanding that, even in this case, Ms. Franklin, the government accepted its ability to enter into a consent decree. And there's no issue. Even the government concedes that it's a consent decree. And the and there is no issue as to whether the executive has authority to enter into the consent decree under the Constitution and under the
contract and under the statutes. The normal location for a claim for damages under a contract with the federal government is in the Court of Federal Claims.
Your Honor, but this was a court order, and so. The parties had the clear intent. The executive had the authority to enter into a court order. I don't think there's any issue. There's no dispute that the executive had the authority, the constitutional authority, and the statutory authority under Title VII to subject itself to the inherent powers of the Article III judge.
Well,
the question is, I would argue that
the inherent powers of Article III judges have not been found as a general matter to justify disregard of sovereign immunity.
But, Your Honor, the issue is whether one issue is to the extent that the plaintiff in this case and plaintiffs in most of these cases where the government has subjected itself to the coercive powers of the judge is what type of remedies was the plaintiff asking for. And for instance, in this case, it was very clear even from the start that Mrs. Franklin Mason was requesting equitable relief under the court order. She was asking for specific performance. Even early on, the only reference to a request for monetary relief was relative to attorney fees. After a couple of years go by, and she did not receive the relief from the court relative to specific performance, she asked for modification.
Is it your experience that provisions like this are common in the settlement agreements, provisions with the government where the government contemplates damages for violations of the settlement agreement? Or the consent decree?
In my experience or in my survey of...
Both.
In my experience, most times the United States will settle a case in a fashion not dissimilar to the way it was settled in this case. I'm going to be honest with you. In my personal experience, I don't recall where there has been a retention of jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
I would say this, based on the record, I wasn't counsel below, but based on the record and conversations with my client, the activity of the influence of Judge Sullivan in making this case settle. After all, Your Honor, at the time that the case had settled, Ms. Franklin Mason had been before the EEOC. She had a hearing. The issue started in 1989. She had a full administrative hearing. She got full relief from that administrative hearing. The United States rejected that relief. She had to file suit. And by 1999, this case was essentially 10 years old. And the influence of Your Honor, the influence of the judge in fashioning this settlement was, and Judge Sullivan was profound and was great. But I would also, Your Honor, argue that in terms of the monetary damages that were available to the court and to Ms. and what Ms. Franklin Mason was arguing for in terms of back pay and front pay, those are equitable damages. I would still, Your Honor, maintain that the courts have the power to punish, to use monetary sanctions against the government, to sanction and coerce the government to do what they have obligated themselves, not just under the contract, but under the court order. I would argue, Your Honor, that in terms of Kokanen in particular, that these issues, and Your Honor, I see that my time is up. May I just briefly wind up? That these issues have been so basic to Court of Federal Claims, and even basic to this court, to the extent that this is apparently and essentially a case of first impression in front of this court, that even the government, at every turn except for when they got into this court, accepted the notion that the executive had the authority to enter into this kind of contract and into this kind of order and be subjected to this kind of order. And so much so that they have never argued otherwise. In Schaefer versus Veneman, this court has implied that a settlement order, a settlement that has been reduced to an order with a retention of jurisdiction in a fashion that is consistent with Kokanen, that this court would argue or would find that the district court properly would retain jurisdiction over a settlement agreement that's reduced to an order consistent with Kokanen. Your Honor, Ms. Franklin Mason is here after many, many, many years. This case has been in front of the district court, in front of the Court of Federal Claims, has been back to the district court. I submit that the only authority that has decided or ruled that Kokanen would not apply in this case is Judge Roberts. I submit that Judge Roberts was wrong and Judge Braden was correct in her analysis from the Court of Federal Claims. And after 17 years of adjudication and litigation in this case, I request, Your Honor, that this case be remanded to Judge Roberts for further proceedings so that a swift and final resolution of this case can be had. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Jones.
May it please the Court, Alan Birch on behalf of the Department of the Navy. We believe the case is controlled by the Doctrine of Sovereign Immunity, which we do believe.
So why not argue that before now? It's been going on for decades. Your position, as I understand it, is that the government illegally entered into the original settlement agreement, or at least entered into a settlement agreement consent decree that had an illegal provision in it that was a key, potentially, provision of the settlement.
Our position is that the government did lack authority to make that promise.
Hasn't the government been doing that in other cases as well?
Nothing I'm aware of, and it has certainly stopped since this court's decision in Brown versus United States back in 2003. We've become much more sensitive to that issue, and as I've seen...
Are you talking about your office?
My office.
How about nationally? Does the government enter into consent decrees with this kind of provision in it around the country, and is this a Department of Justice-wide position?
I can't speak on behalf of what's been filed and nationwide. I don't have a foundation. That's certainly not on the record. With respect to internal DOJ, I can tell you that we have developed a policy to coordinate on consent decrees and where they belong in terms of adjudication.
No longer enter into consent decrees that have this kind of provision in it.
It's not explicitly covered by the policy.
As opposed to entering into
it
and then jamming people after the fact.
It would really surprise me if that were going on at all, and particularly in light of the policy that has been developed.
Counsel, your answer to Judge Kavanaugh, that part of the settlement is unenforceable, depends on part of your brief arguing that there depends on quite a few things, but one of the things it depends on is your argument that the Court of Federal Claims lacks jurisdiction, and you very helpfully bring our attention to Bensand.
Yes.
And you distinguish it on the basis that the settlement there was for ALJ, not for a judge.
Right.
But I honestly have to say I'm lost as to why that should make any difference. The basic proposition that consent decrees and contracts are not mutually exclusive seems to be a central one.
Well, I don't think that's quite right, because it's not accurate enough. It's not precise enough. The general notion in Van de Sant that the two are not mutually exclusive, the case law doesn't go that far. What it does, particularly the case law that even Van de Sant discusses, says is that with respect to interpreting consent decrees, yes, it is appropriate to use the methods of construction for a contract. But the Van de Sant court stretches the, in particular, page 1350, its discussion of the ITT case, which I take to be the core of the court's reasoning on this issue. It stretches the quote from ITT, a consent decree or order is to be construed for enforcement purposes, basically, as a contract. The first paragraph, quoting ITT, it stretches the notion of construction to the last sentence of that paragraph, should be viewed for enforcement purposes as having the attributes of a contract. And that's where I think that's the key weakness here. When it comes to enforcement and a forum and the remedies that go with it, that's where the differences arise, the key differences between a consent decree and a contract. A contract with the United States would be enforceable under the Tucker Act with a claim for damages in the Court of Federal Claims. A consent decree like this one that reserved or jurisdiction in the district court would be enforceable by the district court with its traditional enforcement powers, the injunctive. But those powers are limited by sovereign immunity, as I believe you acknowledge.
Right. What?
So the inherent authority is limited both by sovereign immunity and it's a self-limiting concept. I mean, the Supreme Court has said in its cases on inherent authority that, for example, it has not upheld the notion that you can simply issue damages. It has gone as far as awarding attorney's fees in exceptional cases, but it has viewed that as an outgrowth of its own inherent power to supervise the bar. I would point you to the Alyeska case, 421 U.S. 240, 1975, which is...
You certainly aren't questioning the proposition
that there is...
The Court of Federal Claims has jurisdiction to award damages in contract claims between persons in the United States.
Yes,
right?
The Holmes case under...
You have to argue that the consent decree here is not a contract.
That's right. That's right. That's our position. It's not a contract.
I mean, there's a common... The court talks, as I recall, about the settlement agreement there as being a contract.
That's right. It was an out-of-court contract. Yes. It was not a consent decree. That's the key distinction.
So an out-of-court contract does not belong to the species contract?
No. An out-of-court contract is a contract and could be enforceable under the Tucker Act if the government were a party. It's the distinction.
In-court contract is not a contract. The adjectival phrase in court overpowers the word contract.
No, you look to the standard of, as I explained in the brief, what is an injunction under a rule, I think it's 65.
Why are we going to do injunctions?
Because that's what a consent decree is.
Damages under an agreement.
You look to the rule to define what is a consent decree. This is a consent decree because it was issued by the court and includes the specific terms that the party must do or not do.
I still haven't had a word from the court. It includes it's being simultaneously a contract. In fact, I've heard words from you that suggest that it is a contract. It's a court contract, which sounds like a species of contract.
Well, I believe that the as we explained in the brief, there the limited cases on the point distinguish between the two and say it is either one or the other for purposes of enforcement. And here the parties were very clear that they wanted to seek enforcement from the district court. The inherent power of the district court, I might add, is also limited independently by the case law that suggests, I'm reading from a case I did not cite in my brief, Deegan versus United States, 517 U.S. 820 from 1996, quote, a court's inherent power is limited by the necessity giving rise to its exercise, end quote. This was its summary of the limited nature and why the courts need to stick to the more limited remedies. Similarly, in Chambers, which was a case cited by Deegan, 501 U.S. 32 at 44, 1991 case, quote, because of their very potency, inherent powers must be exercised with restraint and discretion. And then I would also mention the Alyeska case, which shows the very high standard that the court imposes for issuing even attorney's fees as an example of inherent power. The limited nature of the inherent power, even aside what, from sovereign immunity, this doesn't get you to damages.
Right. On sovereign immunity, one thing I've struggled with in trying to think about this case is Title VII itself waives sovereign immunity against the government
for acts of discrimination and retaliation.
Right.
And I would point out that she
why isn't that naturally read, or what case says that something like the Title VII waiver of sovereign immunity should not be naturally read to encompass, subsume a settlement agreement, a consent decree that itself contemplates damages for violation of the consent decree. In other words, those damages would be subsumed within the damages you could have gotten originally had there not been a settlement for which there is a waiver of sovereign immunity.
Even if it's susceptible to that reading, I think you need to take the narrower reading based on sovereign immunity.
Right, but is there a case that you're aware of that talks about that?
Not a Title VII case.
How about other cases where they talk about the provision that does waive sovereign immunity explicitly cannot be read to waive sovereign immunity for violations of the
consent decree? I would point you to another case I did not cite in my brief. I'm sorry. The Presidential Gardens case from the Second Circuit, 175 F3rd 132. That's from 1999. And it has a discussion in a bankruptcy context of a consent decree that was entered into by parties. And the parties sought enforcement, including damages, and the circuit found, for sovereign immunity reasons, that the district court was not allowed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that analysis it carries over perfectly and perfectly supports our position here, that whether you look at it from... Sorry?
With respect to the district court.
Let's answer that question first.
With respect to the district court, not to the Court of Federal Claims. I didn't hear anything in your summary of the Second Circuit case that bore upon the jurisdiction of the Court of Federal Claims.
The Second Circuit does suggest the court that case may belong there, but that's in dicta in that case, and we would disagree with that dicta. That's the reason we've set forth.
Obviously, the government attorneys who entered into the original agreement here, and as I understand in a few other cases, didn't think sovereign immunity was a bar. What was going on?
An issue missed, Your Honor. It escaped the parties. It was initially flagged by a magistrate judge in this case.
Right.
It happens. It's not a satisfying answer.
And it's a pretty big, well, it would seem like, and I don't know how to even get my hands around this. It would seem like the government probably enters into lots of settlement agreements in lots of different cases around the country. We know that.
Oh, yes, of course.
But how many of them have damages provisions like this in them? That's one of the things I'm worried about here is we're...
Right. In my limited experience, it's very... that's the first one I've ever seen. It's the only one I've ever seen in my experience that is a district court consent decree with the government that has damages, a provision for damages. Now, I don't see a wide variety of all the urban cases. I'm at the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Right. I understand. So,
and I can tell you that our practice has changed radically since 2003. When we became much more sensitized to this issue from the Brown versus United States case. We've worked much harder to coordinate with the other divisions internally, DOJ. That effort culminated, as I mentioned, in a recent issuance of a policy on these. So the games of ping pong were very sensitive to avoiding those in the future. I would also add that with respect to jurisdiction, that has not happened in this case. It's merely the sovereign immunity issue, as you pointed out, that is different. The Presidential Gardens case points out, like many other cases, that sovereign immunity is a jurisdictional issue and therefore technically can be raised at any time.
Is that the only one you found on the question I asked?
It's the most specific.
Okay. I'll look at that.
Perhaps I missed this. Could you explain to me again why an agreement to settle under Title VII would not be a contract for purposes of the Tucker Act?
Because we believe that the fundamental reason is a sovereign immunity reason of if it's capable of being interpreted, Title VII and the Tucker Act are capable of interpreting consistent with our position, which is the narrower position, that is the way it should be interpreted. The Title VII should be interpreted as authorizing a cause of action based on claims of discrimination or retaliation, but not on claims of acts of violations of a consent decree or a breach of a contractual settlement agreement. I would point out, it's important
to
note.
I missed something here, and I want to understand what's going on here. You're saying Title VII shouldn't be interpreted that way.
That's right. Title
VII
should.
Unless you have reduced that claim to an agreement, what prevents us from interpreting the agreement that way?
Well, I think you can similarly read the Tucker Act as applying only to contracts and not to consent decrees.
All right, but why is that not a contract?
Because of the difference in forum and remedies, it's a consent decree, and so you go to...
I'm sorry, the difference in forum, you've addressed most of your argument explaining why the district court isn't a forum.
The district court is the proper forum, that's my whole point, to enforce its own consent decree, not a contractual agreement.
How can it enforce it?
By injunctive relief and...
What if the injunctive relief is not complied with?
Well, that's the issue that the court faces in all cases where it's injunctive relief. It's nothing unique to here. I would also add that she has not sought to invoke the court's...
Injunctive relief sounds really awkward here. I mean, it would require the court getting into the personnel structure of the Navy in an extraordinarily intrusive way.
Right.
You aren't seriously asking for that, are you?
No.
What you could do is to say that's impossible, damages are impossible, go home, right?
Well, the equities of the situation are would need to be closely considered. I mean, I think you can see from the district court record here, the report and recommendation by the magistrate judge, that equities are fairly favorable to the government in terms of what's possible and not possible, and the government's efforts to create the position. I would also add that, Ms. Jones mentioned the contempt power. She's not sought remedy through contempt of court. That is another option. She would need to meet higher standards than simply showing a violation. Her current request here is only for the damages, by the way. It's not for the injunctive relief that she sought earlier. And finally, it's worth noting that she does have a separate civil action pending under Title VII based on the same actions. But in that case, the theory is that it is discrimination and retaliation. And so that's where Title VII provides a potential remedy in this case.
Okay. Let me ask you something. There's a 06 case from this court called Rashan.
Yes.
Okay. It says, in two decisions of this court, we have made clear that a claim for breach of a Title VII settlement agreement is a contract claim within the meaning of the Tucker Act, and therefore for claims exceeding $10,000, exceeding the $10,000 jurisdiction, belongs to the Court of Federal Claims.
Right.
So is this just, are we wrong?
No, those refer to out-of-court settlements. Those are not consent decrees.
So you're, even if it's an out-of-court settlement, it can be a contract.
Yes, and the Federal Circuit's very clear about that in the Holmes case, which is a Title VII out-of-court settlement agreement. And the Holmes decision says, yes, those are contracts. They belong, a violation, a breach claim seeking, a claim based on breach of contract, seeking contractual remedies against the United States. That's actionable in the Court of Federal Claims. That's clear. But those are for the contractual settlements, the ones that are not explicitly put into a consent decree, which we think has the form, function, and remedies of an injunction and should be treated as such. That's the key, one of the key distinctions.
On sovereign immunity again, because we were talking about injunctive relief, if that's violated or not complied with by the government, the district court has the power to impose contempt sanctions, right?
Yes, generally, that's right.
And that can include money?
Yes.
And there's right. No sovereign immunity issue there?
I don't think so, but the key point here is she has not sought contempt in this case.
Why aren't the...
She would need to meet the higher standards.
Well, and the higher standard being?
Generally, contempt requires...
Clear violation of
a clear court order by clear and convincing evidence.
Why couldn't this provision be construed as essentially contemplating monetary relief for violations of the consent decree akin to what's available for contempt?
It would need to be litigated as a contempt motion at that point, and that's not how
it hasn't
been presented.
Really hasn't been litigated yet because we've been off on these jurisdictional questions.
The jurisdictional issue came up only after the magistrate judge had a whole hearing on it. It's not as though the merits have been completely unaddressed. But it has not been litigated or presented by
Ms. Franklin Mason. It was litigated as the consent decree was violated.
Right, and that's all that under Franklin Mason's theory that she needs.
As opposed to clearly violated.
Yes, a clear provision that was clearly violated by clear and convincing evidence.
But your position is that there is monetary relief available for at least a clear violation of the consent decree.
If she can prove
there's not monetary relief available for a violation of the consent decree.
If she could prove up a contempt, then perhaps that I would.
If your position on that after further thought in the next day or two changes, let us know.
Okay, I will.
Because I'm having a little trouble slicing the sovereign immunity between the contempt.
I think that's the right answer. I'm not positive, and so I'll correct it if it's wrong that the contempt powers would reach the United States. If there are no further questions, we would ask that the dismissal be affirmed on the basis of sovereign immunity. Thank you.
Just briefly, Your Honors, Judge Kavanaugh, I would submit that my view of the case is much as yours in terms of the issue of contempt and the ability of the court to impose monetary damages for a contempt violation. I would argue that the way that the, and again, I wasn't counsel below, but the way that the case was argued below encompassed arguments that not only that the government was in violation, but by necessity was in contempt. Was an order of to show cause filed, to show cause why they should not be in contempt filed? No, but inherent, I would argue that inherent in the various motions to enforce the agreement was, and then when it was clear that the agreement was not being enforced, that the contemplation of damages was for the contempt of the government's inability to abide by the agreement. I would argue, Your Honor, that this case is a consent decree, that on the face of the complaint filed by the plaintiff below, and insofar as she asked for specific relief in terms of performance and attorney's fees, and only the issue of damages, compensatory damages and back pay, those issues were raised sometime down the line, probably 5 years down the line, that the fact that the initial complaint in its four corners asks for specific relief and equitable relief, her motion was properly before the district court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The case will be submitted.